The diagram is meant to be a useful tool. It is meant to be a method of analysis that you can apply to any system of thought, period. Marxism, Christianity, Mormonism, Buddhism, existentialism, atheism, no matter what it is meant to give you, as it were, the skeletons of every system. The flesh, the cartilage of that system, will differ from system to system, but every system will have the following things. Number one, you have the person who holds the system. Now, you can be talking about the founder of that system, such as Jean Ostrok, who developed the higher documentary hypothesis of the denial of the authorship of the Pentateuch by Moses. Or you can deal with someone who holds to a position, and you need to think in terms of the person who holds it. Positions and theories and systems are believed by people, and we need to remember that. And that's why we need to be gracious. That's why we need to have that catholicity of attitude in which you realize that people have the right to believe whatever they want to believe, but also that you have the right to believe what you want to believe, and you have a right to share with them what you believe in the hope that they will abandon what they believe to believe what you believe and share with them the gospel of Christ. So you have the person. You cannot simply deal with systems in abstract. I can think of Friedrich Nietzsche. I think it is important that you understand the background of that man and how that he rebelled against his Christian upbringing and how he sought to do everything he possibly could to fight and to destroy the faith, the pietistic faith of his forefathers. He particularly hated Jesus Christ. He developed his concept of the Superman or the Übermensch, particularly in his book, Thus Spoke as Zarathustra. And he developed his attack against Christianity by attacking the person of Jesus Christ. He ultimately went insane due to syphilis, and he was put away finally. And he used to write letters in crayons, I am sure, and he always signed them Jesus Christ. In his insanity, he became the person that he hated more than any other person in the world. It was Nietzsche who made the statement, God is dead. I remember New York City back in the 70s. One student went to a large Jewish theological seminary and wrote on the wall, this is the outside of the building, wrote, God is dead, signed Nietzsche. And some bright student went out with his spray can and said, Nietzsche is dead, signed God. I don't know if any of you ever saw that graffiti. It was in magazines. Well, Nietzsche's the one who began that. He said, the concept of God is over with. We must jettison the ideas of kindness, love, compassion, gentleness, consideration. He called those things slave ethics. He said, if you really want to have a true ethic, then instead of compassion, you should have a cold, hard heart. Instead of showing mercy, twist the knife a little bit as you run it through them. Nietzsche developed his master ethics as the ethics of the Übermensch, the super race that was to come. And guess who read Nietzsche? A boy by a paper hanger from Austria named Adolf Hitler, who also talked an awful lot about the Übermensch and about the Aryan race and about the necessity of cleaning up the racial purity of the German people to create this master race where there would be no mercy. And when you think of the SS herding women with babies into their arms, into the gas chambers, reducing people to soap, fertilizer for the fields, skinning people. There was one concentration camp that was known particularly because the wife of the commandant ordered that whenever a prisoner was taken who had a tattoo, he was skinned. And his skin was tanned, and she had pocketbooks, lampshades, shoes, gloves, made with the tanned skins of tattooed men. Was there any mercy as they herded them into those gas chambers? No. But you see, with that type of Nazi mentality, that was good. What Nietzsche said was good. But you see how Nietzsche ended up? He ended up insane. He could not live what he believed. And he ended up, in his insanity, thinking he was Jesus Christ, the person that he hated. You have to know a little bit about the history of someone. As I read through the Encyclopedia of Philosophy, I made a note of how many of the hostile philosophers came from Christian homes, came from clergymen's homes. What was shocking to me, some of the most vicious atheists came from the homes of clergymen. They rebelled against everything that their parents stood for. They didn't want it. They won't have anything to do with it. Utterly repudiated and sought to deal with it. For you know, there's two types of atheists. There are the benign and malignant atheists. Benign atheists say, well, I don't believe in God, but if you want to believe in one, that's your own business. That's your ball of wax. It's your bed. You can sit down and you can lie in it. That's a benign atheist. A malignant atheist is one who says, I don't believe in God, and I'm going to make sure that you don't by the time I'm through with you. These are the characters, like over in Dickinson College. One of them, to start out his Bible course, this is several years ago, would introduce his mentality to the scriptures by saying, how many of you believe in the Bible? And when the students raised their hand, he promptly took the Bible and threw it across the room so it hit the wall and came down crashing to the floor. Now, it was a great shocking approach, but what was he trying to tell these students? By the time I'm through with you, that's what you'll do with the Bible too. Now, that guy probably came from a Christian home. That guy probably had a religious upbringing, and no doubt he got into immorality, or he got into something which his conscience bothered him, and because of it, he has a vendetta against God. Vicious. He's malignant. The benign atheists, well, I can handle them. The malignant ones are a little difficult to handle because they're not interested in reason. They're not interested in anything because they have an axe to grind. And they want to make sure that every Christian gets their head chopped off. So you've got to understand something about the person. Find out a little bit about their history. You want to know why someone believes what they believe? Talk with them for a while. Some people believe what they believe because they picked it up from their parents and they never really cared to even think about it. Too many people pick up their religion like dogs pick up fleas. This is why I do thank God that I had no religious upbringing, that I did not have to endure innumerable stories of Joseph's coat of many colors, as I've heard people complain to me that they've heard it ad nauseum. Well, you see, you've got to understand the person. Secondly, you've got to understand that this person believes in certain first principles, certain assumptions, certain things which they assume to be true, which they have never proven to themselves, or which they have examined and thus have chosen consciously as their first principles. So everybody has presuppositions. They presuppose. They assume certain things to be true. Most people never think about their presuppositions. In philosophy, we say that these people are not epistemologically self-conscious. It's a lot of big words. What it means, this person has never sat down and reflected on the most basic foundational assumptions they have. Well, these people have faith in these presuppositions. It can be a naive faith. They just assume it to be true because that's the way they were taught. Or it can be a leap in the dark, much like the existentialist, like Kierkegaard. And he says, well, I leap into the arms of nothing. As I mentioned, for some reason, he felt comforted because he capitalized the word the letter N in the word nothing. For some reason, that meant something to him. Nothing is nothing. I don't care if you capitalize it or not. But it was a leap into the dark, you see. And a lot of modern theologians say Christianity is a leap in the dark. You've just got to accept it blindly. Open up your mouth. Just believe it. Take it in. Or there are those who have come to Christianity by other roads. Or those who have taken their faith by other roads. They have sought to pick their assumptions and to sit down and sift through their presuppositions, throwing out this one, that one, or the other, and keeping this, that one, or the other, or adopting new ones. So when you're dealing with the system, you have to ask, what is this man assuming to be true? For example, in the back of your textbook, I met a professor one time who said, well, the resurrection of Jesus Christ was impossible. I said, well, that's not really what you're saying. He said, well, that's what I'm saying. I said, no, what you're saying is that you are assuming that it is true that we are living in a closed system ordered by natural law, and that miracles are impossible because you define a miracle as a violation of natural law. He said, well, I do. I said, you have to prove that before you can prove that Christ did not rise from the dead. He said, oh. He said, well, I don't have to prove that. That is truth. That is fact. I said, no, you're assuming it to be true. What you need to do, here is the concept you just gave me. Christ could not have been raised from the dead. Underneath that, you have a presupposition. Your concept arose from that. So I'm not going to deal with this. I'm going to deal with this. And I'm going to throw quantum mechanics your way. We're going to have a little chat about Heisenberg's principle of uncertainty. And you're going to find that we no longer can view that we live in a closed universe ordered by natural law. That world and life view, which originated with Isaac Newton, is dead as a dodo. Einstein was the first one to put the skewer to the heart of that view. It's a mechanistic view of the universe. And quantum mechanics, Reichenbacher and others, after Einstein, have finished it off. There's absolutely no scientific verification of Newton's idea that we're living in a mechanistic universe like a big machine running according to laws. A law is now defined in modern physics as a propositional statement placed on a piece of paper which shows you psychologically how people seek to interpret reality. So in other words, scientific laws are now in the mind and are not viewed as being in the world. But you see, that guy who said over here, Jesus Christ did not rise from the dead, his real problem was over here. He was assuming on the level of his presuppositions that the universe is a closed system run by natural law. Therefore, nothing like that can happen. And you have to deal with the presuppositions, those things which are assumed, which are beneath the visible concepts. Then you have the concepts of the ideas which work their way out, hopefully out of the presuppositions. And then the whole system is going to take you someplace. There's a logical conclusion. So with Nietzsche, if I had to give a lecture on Nietzsche's ethics, I would point out as one of many things that if you want to know the logical conclusion of Nietzsche's Übermensch ethics, look at Buchenwald and Auschwitz and Dachau. You will see the grand conclusion of Nietzsche's ethics. It led to death and destruction for millions of people. So you have a right to say, hey, if we take your position logically to its conclusion, it ends in absurdity. It ends in a position that you neither you nor I can live with or believe. So this basic scheme, this basic grid, this basic pair of glasses, this X-ray machine, if I can put it that way, is the method by which you examine any philosophic system. Now, with this diagram in mind, let's begin to examine the problem of how a Christian seeks to win a non-Christian to the Lord Jesus Christ. The first questions that we must put forth deal with the person who holds the particular position we wish to refute. For you see, it is the person who asks the most fundamental and basic questions that a man or woman can ever ask. Archaeologists and anthropologists at this point are pretty much agreed that as far back as we can go with the artifacts and with written history, mankind has always asked, where did I come from? The origin of man. What am I? Who am I? The nature of man. Why am I here? The purpose of man, or the meaning of man. And where am I going? The destiny of man. Even when they went back to the Neanderthal man, who probably was simply some individuals who were suffering from a very severe case of arthritis, and thus they were deformed. Even if you go to the Neanderthal man, you discover that they buried their dead with bowls of food and flowers, and with their weapons. The archaeologists and the anthropologists have found that no matter where man is, be it the ancient Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Aztecs, the Hottentots of South Africa, the Eskimos, all of humanity has always, in every place, developed answers to those basic questions. Either they say that we came from God, or there was a big turtle sitting on another turtle, or we came from the wind. But you see, they have answers to those questions. Where did we come from? Who and what are we? Why are we here? And where are we going? Everyone is going to think in terms of those questions sometime or later. Some people do a lot earlier than others. I'm afraid to say, in a hedonistic society in which we live, people get so busy they don't really ask themselves these questions until perhaps they're getting old, and they're sick, and they're dying. And all of a sudden, when you begin to deal with the elderly, you know what you begin to hear. Why was I put here on earth? For two years, I went to a veterans hospital and dealt with the Vietnam veterans. For 2 years, every Sunday after I went to the veterans hospital, I went to an old folks home. And after 2 years, every Sunday, I got to know these people quite well. And I found the sick and the ill were asking, why am I here? Where am I going? These people were forced to deal with the most basic questions. And you see, the Christian at this point has something wonderful to share with people. The Christian says, aren't we dealing with someone created in God's image? You know where you came from? God made you. You're not a bit of ooze that oozed out of ooze that's oozing back into ooze. You're not a chance-produced animal through the meaningless and purposeless fluke of an evolutionary process. You have significance. You have greatness. You have importance. You have meaning. God made you. And you're here to bear His image. You alone, of all the creatures in this world, were to bear the image of God, so that when man was created, there was a consultation in the Trinity, and they said, let us make man in our image and in our likeness. And despite what the Mormons say, the Scriptures nowhere speak of that image being physical, for God is not a male, says the prophet. God is not a man. The image of God refers to functions. God is a self-conscious cognitive ego. In other words, He can say, I am. You realize how great that is? I am. You know what? I'm a self-conscious cognitive ego. I say I am. Does this pew say I am? Does a cat say I am? Your people involved in psychological research and attempt to deal with animals at all have always found that the mirror test reveals that animals do not have a self-conscious cognitive ego. If your parakeet is lonely, what will the pet shop owner tell you to do? Put a mirror in there. Because when the parakeet looks, He will think there's another parakeet, and he will carry on and talk and have a good old time. Every spring, usually, I hate to say it because it hurts my heart and feelings, I hear a big thump at our picture window there in the living room. And I go outside, and I bring out my daughter, and there's a dead bird, killed itself right there. Why? I said, honey, when the birds get their territorial feelings and drive and aggressiveness, this bird comes along and he sees his own reflection in the glass, thinks it's another bird, and kaplow! He's dead, baby. Now, when you look in a mirror, you don't think that's somebody else, like a dog go up and try to lick and sniff. You know that's you. And that's me. But the dogs don't know it's them. The birds don't know. Man is a self-conscious cognitive ego. He says, I am. And you see, when God created man in his image, it referred to various functions. Man is a thinking being, like God. Man is a feeling being. Man is a choosing being. Man is a rational being. Man is capable of reason. Man is capable of art. Animals don't produce art. Now, in New York City, they've got this one man who has a monkey trained. Now, you give the brush to the monkey, and he'll dab some paint on the canvas. But that's mimicking what man has done. If they want to show the animals do art, let's go to some place in Africa where no human beings were ever existed. And we better find a gallery up by the local gorillas or the chimpanzees or somebody. You won't find that. You see, man has these aspirations, these abilities, the ability to say, I am. And what's really tremendous as you deal with non-Christians is you can usually start out by saying, hey, I know what you are, and you don't know what you are. During the heyday of the drug culture in the late 60s and then to the early 70s, in Greenwich Village, I'd often sit down at this Christian coffee house, and after giving whoever came, usually more than one person, some coffee and tea and donuts and stuff, I said, hey, you know, I know who you really are. And they'd look at me. I said, I really do, but I don't think you have an idea who you are. They say, you don't know me. I never met you before. Yeah, but I know who really you are. They said, who? You were created in God's image. You're important. You're significant. You have meaning. You think you're a fluke of the evolutionary process. Picked up by chance. No meaning. No why. Nothing. But like a dog. And we'd enter into a good discussion on whether or not the evolutionary process, atheistic evolution with meaninglessness, purposelessness, no rhyme, no beginning, no end, and no goal. How that possibly could have produced man who thinks, who aspires to meaning, who aspires to hope. In one debate one time, the guy went on and on about the evolutionary process and how that man was the crowning glory and climax of the process. I said, let me ask you a question. If this room that we're now living in is the universe and all there is here, this is it. And this room was filled with water so that the universe is a liquid universe. It's filled with water. And there were fish in that world, happy fish, running around and swimming and splashing and having a good time. And some of these fish developed lungs. What would those fish aspire to do with those lungs? To breathe. But this is a liquid universe. What would happen to the fish who developed lungs in a liquid universe? They'd die. Was that a step forward in evolution when an animal develops faculties and facilities for things that it cannot find a realization or satisfaction? He agreed that that creature, which developed lungs in a liquid universe, would be a backward step because it would not lead to the survival of the race. I said, let me ask you a question. You're telling me that we're living in a universe in which there's no meaning, and yet man aspires for meaning. You're telling me we're living in a universe where there's no hope, and yet everything in me, I want hope. You're telling me there's no God and man aspires for God and for meaning and significance and hope and love and beauty and trust? You're telling me that I'm a fish that developed lungs in a liquid world. And you tell me I'm the climax of the evolutionary process? No thanks. I'd rather go back to the banana tree and have a tail and spend my time scratching my neighbor's head than to have aspirations for things you tell me I cannot have. But you see, the universality, anthropologically speaking, of man's aspirations for beauty, even the primitive cave people did art. It's National Geographic had dug up and up in northern Canada how the earliest Eskimos were taking elephant tusks and carving them. Where does art come from? Is that man's aspiration of beauty? That's why Balfour, one of the great literacists of our own time, said, listen, humanism can never explain beauty. I can take person after person and take them out on the veranda and let them see a sunset. And you know what all of them will say? Beautiful. He said, now you explain to me how that sensation of aesthetic beauty, which raced through that person's being, was something that came out of chance in a universe where there is no beauty, where there is no order, where there is no harmony. He said, I will take you to hear a concert by Bach. You will have to say it's beautiful. Where did those aspirations come from? For meaning, for hope, for love, you see. Well, we say to the person, hey, I know what you are. God made you. You're not some meaningless machine, some mindless animal. God made you. And he created you as a cognitive ego. You are, and you know it. You are conscious of yourself. You think, you feel. You have aspirations. And you cannot help but reflect the glory of God. Everything that you see in people reflects the fact that they are created in God's world. And if they do not live according to God's laws, they're not going to break God's law. They're going to break themselves. Imagine someone said, well, I'm going to break the law of gravity by jumping off this building. Who's going to break? That's one of my questions, you say. And people say, well, I'm going to break the moral laws of God. Yeah. Those laws will be standing long after you go to the grave with syphilis and gonorrhea. Long after you get herpes, the laws of God will be there. And this is something that I think is very important for Christians to remember as you deal with people, is that they are created in the image of God and they are still in the image of God. James chapter 3 and verse 9, James said, how can you claim to praise God and then turn around and curse a man who is created in the image of God? Now, I'm aware that Lutheran theology taught that the image of God was totally eradicated from man, and thus man is no longer in the image of God. I disagree with Luther at this point and take the position with Calvin and Zwingli and the others. The scripture, such as James 3 and verse 9, says that man is still in the image of God. No matter how corrupt, no matter how depraved, he is still worth saving. He is still valuable. He is still has intrinsic worth and I care. Now, do you see why people who believe in euthanasia believe in what they believe? Kill the old people. They cost too much money. Hitler showed us the way to deal with cripples. Take them to the gas chambers. Give them a shot of poison. Have suicide clinics like they do in Sweden so you can go in and die and get it over with. And when England, one girl went to her grandmother. And the girl wanted her inheritance so she could go on living her disco life. And she did her best to persuade her grandmother to kill herself so that she could get her inheritance right away instead of living so long. But you see, what does that mean? It means these people do not consider human life intrinsically valuable. This is why the pro-life people are not making much headway. Pro-life, so far as against euthanasia, pro-life is against infanticide or abortion. they're not going to make much headway because they're not dealing with the philosophic presupposition that human life is not intrinsically valuable. You can dispose of babies or of old people like you do tissues. And you see, as long as you don't deal with that issue, you're not really going to deal with the other issues which arise from that. When Skinner wrote his book, Skinner, Harvard professor, Beyond Freedom and Dignity, he laid out the idea of the perfect humanistic society in which you as an individual no longer was viewed as having meaning, hope, significance, or intrinsic worth. You are nothing. You can do nothing. If I use you, and in terms of utility or practicality, you are useful for the state, you will be allowed to exist. If you get in the way, you will be not killed, eradicated, released from the bondage of life, or some other nice way of putting it, where you simply follow in the footsteps of Adolf Hitler and take the crippled, the deranged, the sick, the old, and the unwanted, and kill them. Beyond Freedom and Dignity by Skinner. You see, as a Christian, you can say to these people, hey, you're created in God's image. And you know what? Deep down, you really know this. For in Romans chapter 1, 18 through 25, here the Apostle Paul states, because man is created in the image of God, in his heart of hearts, he knows that there is a creator. There is a mastermind behind this universe. He knows instinctively there is something beyond, there is someone to whom he is accountable. Thus, your anthropologists have never found a civilization or tribe that was not involved in the worshiping of a deity or deities. Now, you think for a moment. If religion is simply an evolutionary quirk and it's societal and cultural, why is it universal so far as mankind is concerned? Man instinctively knows this. Thus he states in verse 21, although they knew God, no taste they on, even though in their hearts of hearts, in their soul, in their deepest being, in the moments when they are quiet or when they're in the foxhole, they know there's a God. Yet they will seek to suppress that knowledge and unrighteousness. Never forget one guy I was working with at General Motors who was a very malignant atheist, and he particularly liked grilling the seminary students who got jobs during the summer. And since I was working across the assembly line from him, he decided I would be a perfect one to grill. And that summer, he got grilled quite effectively. He came up and said, well, if a God exists, why all those people are dying in Vietnam? I said, your real question, John, has to do with the origin of evil. Not really the question of Vietnam, but it's the question of all evil. Retarded people, death, accidents, war, hurricanes. Isn't that true? Yes, and I mean the problem of evil. I says, John, number one, I hardly think that you have ever even read a page of discussion on this issue. The only reason you're bringing it up is to be nasty. And then at that moment, the Lord touched me, and I just stepped forward. And I says, John, you know there's a God. And you know that he exists, and you know that you're accountable to him. He took one step back, hung his head, and all this time he's been the big malignant atheist. Yeah, I know. Zing! And you see, that was the Lord. When the Lord gives you the right time, Proverbs says, a word spoken at the right time can be viewed like apples of gold in a frame of silver. It's beautiful. It's appropriate. And the Lord just had me zing him at that right moment to bring up the fact that he knew it. Now, the next day, guess what he was all over again? An atheist. But you see, his nudity in terms of his soul had been uncovered. There's an account in one of the Christian Jesus to the communist world. As these communists were torturing this Christian turned to the head torturer and says, because it was an older man, he says, how can you do this to me when you prayed to God
when you fought the Germans.
And the guy said,
who told you about that?
Well, what do you mean, who told you? When you're in a foxhole, even the communists are saying, oh God, don't let those bullets hit me. I'm thinking of a relative who's a very wealthy woman. Her husband had $70 million. She herself came from a very wealthy background. And I went to talk to her about the gospel, and her response to me, I remember standing in the elevator, Bob, the poor need God. I have no need of God. Why should I believe in God? I have everything I need. Well, you couldn't get to Aunt Ruth because she had no religion. She had no feelings for religion because she had no need of God. The poor need God. When her husband had a stroke, she got on the phone the first thing, please pray for Arthur. Now she needs God, you see? When a person's marriage is falling apart, all of a sudden they need God. You see, the people are really hypocrites. Whereas, Scripture clearly indicates that in their heart of hearts, they know that God exists. They know it because the creation around them is so self-evident. Look at the stars. Look at even Einstein. Lincoln Barnett's book, The Universe and Dr. Einstein, reveals how Einstein said there has to be a God. This world is too mathematically precise. This universe, when I do an equation, it works. He says there has to be God. And he would laugh at the atheistic scientists who would believe in an orderly universe without someone who made the order. The universe is a great building, but have no architect. To be the builder of the universe. Something else that everybody knows, that they are sinful creatures, that they are rebels. Thus it says they know that God exists, and then in chapter 2, 12 through 16, it says they know that they are sinners by their conscience. Now this is something that's very interesting. I have met from time to time people who tell me they do not believe in morality. I'm swift to point out to them that even though they do not believe in morality, they practice morality. And they say, oh no, I don't. I said, now let me ask you a question. You've got that, you have a daughter, don't you? I'm going to take your daughter and I'm going to rape her. And then I'm going to take a razor blade and slowly slice her to death. He said, you better not. I said, you mean it's wrong? You mean it's morally wrong? Well, yes, it's wrong. I remember Dr. Schaefer one time, he was dealing with an Eastern philosophy man, and the man said, there is absolutely no right and wrong. There's, you know, no pain, no evil, no death. Schaefer just went over where the tea kettle was whistling with the boiling water and says, okay, and walked over and proceeded to pour the boiling water on the man's head. And the guy jumped out and said, wah! And he said, wait a second, there is no pain. There is no evil, so I can pour boiling water on you. That's not wrong, is it? There's no pain, then you can't be hurt by it, you see. People may deny morality, but they moralize. They condemn people for doing things. Remember one time in Central Park, we just played a tape. And a couple had stopped and listened, and as soon as we got through, she began to rail at us. I'll never forget, she jumped off that park bench and began to scream, there is no God! I was in the concentration camps! And she showed us the tattoos on her wrists. And she said, oh, there was no God! I saw the people die! And she went on and on how she was a Jewish refugee from the Holocaust. And I said, ma'am, one question. If there is no God, then how can you say that what Hitler did was wrong? If there is no God, then there is no focal point for your absolutes, your ethical absolutes. In ethical theory, moral absolutes ultimately climb to God, who is the absolute of good, of honesty, of love, of compassion. Your ethics depend upon an infinite reference point. To say that it was wrong for Hitler to kill those Jews, you must believe in God or it wasn't wrong. I said, furthermore, you really think Hitler got away with it? that there's no justice in this universe? She said, well, there's got to be justice for Hitler. I said, well, that's what I mean. You cannot believe in justice without believing in the God of justice. There's a day of judgment and Hitler's going to get his due. But if there is no God, then he escaped. Blew himself up in that bomb shelter and escaped. She sat there and said, well, I never thought about it that way before. I saw my edge and just moved right on and says, that's it, man. Without God, you cannot have any morality. Without morality, you cannot make moral judgments against people such as Hitler. The belief that there is no God and that might makes right is what made Hitler do what he did. He felt he was his own God. And you see, when non-Christians attempt to discredit Christianity and to throw out morality, they are actually destroying themselves. For while they say that they don't believe in sin or immorality, nevertheless, they will moralize. They will condemn people for stealing. They will condemn people for killing. And the basis upon which they make the condemnation is something that they previously denied 5 minutes before. Now, even though all men know in their heart of hearts that God exists and that they're sinners, and again, anthropologists point out that in every single civilization known to man, man has always sought to expiate his sin. Regardless of what tribe or what civilization, man always knew that he had sinned against God. And whether it's the Aztecs who cut open the beating heart of its victim, of their victim and offered it up to the sun god, or the Hindus in India who went down to the river and threw their firstborn child to the crocodiles, or whatever group it was, universally man knows that he's in a guilty state before the supreme creator of the universe. So they try to expiate. So Buddhists cut themselves, put fish hooks in their body. Others will go into to become monks, flagellate themselves, walk on fire. People will attempt to take pilgrimage and do anything to get rid of their sin. Now, if sin was a modern idea that some theologian invented, how come it's anthropologically universal? Why is it always there? It's part of humanity. Man's God consciousness and sin consciousness are two things that can never be eradicated from the race of humanity. And even though the Soviets and the communists try, they have never developed the new man that is all religious. Thus the scripture tells us in Romans 1 and verse 18 that men try to suppress or to hold down the truth and unrighteousness. But they will not succeed. They will not be able to suppress the truth completely. As you begin to deal with people, oh, this is a wonderful thing. You realize they're in the image of God. I would deal with derelicts who were alcoholics, who were men in the gutter. We'd pick them up and take them in. We dealt with prostitutes. We dealt with kids on drugs. We dealt with people who were very ugly. People that you wouldn't want to like, wouldn't want to love. But we valued them. They're important. They're important. They have significance. They have worth. And to see these people come to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ, to see their lives changed, is one of the most beautiful things that anyone can notice in the world. I'll close with this illustration. A well-known preacher was preaching an evangelistic message, and a well-known agnostic or atheist, he called himself a skeptic, and that usually means either one, said, I challenge you to a public debate on the existence of God. And the preacher said, on one condition, you bring me a whore who heard your message on skepticism and now is an upright woman in the community. You bring me a drunkard who today is a sober, hard-working, honest man. You bring me a rebel teenager in drugs and dissipation and immorality who now is a productive young person who, through your message of skepticism and atheism and unbelief, is now someone that is producing worth and good for the community. You bring me one person and I'll bring you 1,000. I'll bring you 100. That when Christ touches their life, they change. This is the same agnostic and atheist who, when he was giving his lecture on the fact that there is no hell, at least he thought there was no hell, a drunkard wandered in the meeting. This is reported in the newspaper. And here the man, I think it was Robert Ingersoll, was up lecturing on what he called the absurdity of hell. And a drunkard walked in and said, "Work hell on ya! Work hell on ya!" You bet your hide he's counting on you, you see. People may deny morality, but they will moralize. They will try to escape and suppress the truth, but they will not be able to do it. As you deal with people, remember, they're created in God's image. That's why you can't be mean to people. Be nasty. Don't be mad. You love them because you see the image of God in them. And as you love them, you bring them to a saving knowledge of Christ.